just going to conclude it now. We're in lecture number 8 of philosophy. We're finishing up chapter 8. And the conclusion there that Geisler and Feinberg draw is that human knowledge is fallible and probable in most respects. Human knowledge is fallible and probable in most respects. Only God can know everything with total certainty. In fact, only God can know. Only God can know everything with total certainty. Now, humans may have some certain knowledge, but good philosophers would disagree concerning its nature and its extent. Okay. Realms of mathematics and logic and stuff like that. Now, we as Christians, we believe that God's, this is all written in their conclusion there, God's word is infallible. However, man's knowledge of God's word is fallible because we have fallible minds. We can misinterpret a passage. We can have a less than infallible understanding of the individual words. Therefore, man cannot have certain knowledge of God in a philosophical sense. So what Geisler and Feinberg do is they differentiate between certainty philosophical certainty and what they call certitude. Okay? Certainty, they would say, is impossible in matters of experience. We can see things that are self-definitionally true, but as far as matters of experience, all we can depend on is probable knowledge. Some things are highly probable. Okay? So they say we can't have knowledge with absolute certainty about matters of experience. However, Christians can have a certitude, an added assurance given to the believer, by the internal testimony of the Holy Spirit. This is what I would call kind of personal certainty. Personal certainty. It's kind of like...
supernatural?
No, it's kind of like when you meet another person. You exchange ideas, and after a while, you really, feel like you know that person and stuff. It's more of that. It almost borders to a certain degree on mysticism. You know it, but you can't defend it. You can't put it into words and stuff like that. There's a certain element where we subjectively know that we know that we know, but we can't prove with philosophical certainty.
Right.
So keep in mind, Romans 1, Paul says that all men are without excuse because we know. That's I'm singing your song. All men know that God exists. But what he's saying is that we know in layman's language, which means known with a high degree of probability, known beyond reasonable doubt. But in philosophical terminology, we only know with a high degree of probability. We don't know with certainty. Okay? So, keep that right, yeah.
I think that's why your personal testimony, witness, and apologetics is so effective,
yeah.
Because the intellectual process is so above and attention.
Blaise Pascal is a good corrector to read after a philosophy course, too, because he argued that most of the decisions we make are not based on reason alone anyway. There's feelings, there's emotions, there's so much that comes into it. He says that, the most knowledgeable man in the world can't even read if he has a bad stomachache. Or if he just wakes up with a feeling under the weather. So there's more to man than just reason alone. So keep that in mind that they would differentiate between the two there. Now, chapter 9 deals with how do we perceive the external world. By the way, is certainty possible? I would say in most cases, probably not. And that what we would have to settle for is a high degree, knowing things with a high degree of probability.
Yep.
How do you know your wife is going to be faithful to you? Well, if you had a long courtship, you can know that with a very, very high degree of probability. Beyond all reasonable doubt, you can know that. But you can't know with absolute certainty. That's the same way we have our religious beliefs. That's the same way Kurt knows that that coffee that he made and stuff, the cup of coffee he made, isn't going to poison him to death. He knows with a high degree of probability.
Because I've never poisoned before, doesn't mean I'm going to do it today.
How do we perceive the external world? Three different views here on how we perceive the external world. There's realism, dualism, and idealism. Okay? Three different ways to view answer the question how we perceive the external world. There's extreme or primitive realism, and then there's common sense realism. Now, extreme or primitive realism is the view of a man on the street. Every experienced object exists independently of any observer. Okay, in other words, if I sense it, if I sense the existence of the chair, I see it, I feel it all, then the chair exists. That's it. You know, common sense tells you. It's real. So realism, by the way, is, you know, the belief that the external world, there is a real objective external world that exists, and our idea of it is one and the same with it. The valuation of this is that everyone has been wrong in a judgment about a perception. Anytime you're driving down the road and you see water, puddle of water ahead of you, you get close enough and you saw the reflection of the sun. You saw an object from far away and it looked like a circle, you get closer, it was an oval. That type of thing. Extreme or primitive realism cannot account for illusions or hallucinated objects. Okay? Guy who has an hallucination, that's as real to him as when you see something for real. So how do you differentiate between the two? So some have held to common sense realism, which agrees with primitive realism that physical objects do exist independent of or external to the mind. So both common sense realism and primitive realism, they both agree on this, that physical objects do exist independent of or external to the mind. Realists believe that this chair really does exist independent of my mind and external to my mind, okay? If I leave this room and cannot perceive this chair, it still exists. That makes me a realist, okay? That chair really does exist, okay? However, and then also the common sense realism also agree with primitive realism that physical objects are directly and immediately observable to the mind. I can really experience that chair. Okay? But common sense realism disagrees with primitive realism. It disagrees by viewing the unreal, the illusion, hallucinated object, or illusory objects, the hallucinated object, as subjective objects occurring exclusively in the mind. Okay? So in other words, the fact that if a guy ran into this room with a knife to stab me, and I saw him coming towards me, the common sense realist would say, yes, that is a man independent of my mind, external to my mind, coming towards me, I better defend myself. thought the common sense realist would say that that guy in the corner that's screaming because somebody's going after him with a knife, look around, there is nobody going after him with a knife. Unfortunately, that guy just dropped acid 10 minutes ago. Okay, he's hallucinating. It would have different, and you wake up in the middle of the night with a cold sweat because somebody's out to kill you. No, it was just a dream. Common sense realism would say there are certain times when something's occurring in our mind and not in the real world, and we mistake it for something in the real world. I would be viewed as somewhere in this area of common sense realism. Does not answer all the questions, though. Leaves some questions unanswered that really have to be dealt with, but I would be somewhere in this area. Problems with this view? How do we know that all perceptions aren't illusions? I mean, if we woke up once thinking somebody was trying to kill us and we woke up and realized it was just a nightmare, what if we wake up tomorrow and find out everything we thought for the last 33 or 34 years of our lives was one big dream? How do we know that all perceptions aren't illusions? Another problem is, how can we be mistaken about real objects that are directly observable to the mind? A realist claims that it's directly observable to the mind. Well, if it's directly observable to the mind, how can we be mistaken about it? Okay, so it's not like I'm looking at a photo of the chair. I'm looking at the real chair. How could I be sometimes mistaken to think that there's a real chair there? Well, maybe if I had glass in the room, I thought there was five chairs, and I realized there's only four. How could I be mistaken about that? If it's directly open to observation of the mind. So there are some problems with it, but I hold to some form of that. Now, dualism is the position, it's called the, there's different views of it, but the first view is the representative perception, or the copy theory of knowledge. Descartes, Locke, and Hume all held to this. The idea that there's two distinct and independent orders of existence. There's ideas to realism, we have direct contact with real objects, independent of an external to or of the mind, I don't know, it's from the mind, okay? Well, in dualism you have two realms, the realm of ideas, and then the independent and external world. Okay? So the ideas, the sense data that we get in our minds, that's one distinct order of existence, and the other distinct order is the thing that we're having the idea of. Now this view explains illusions. The farm down a hot highway, the oasis, the stick in the water that appears burnt, it explains those real well. It also explains perceptual relativity real well, that a round coin can look elliptical at times when you hold it a certain way. The problem with this view is that no perception can be proven or disproven. Dualism leads to skepticism about the real world. Now, think of it as a kind of photograph theory of knowledge of the external world. I do not have direct contact with this box of Chips Ahoy cookies. Instead, all I get is like a photograph or a representation of it in my mind. Well, the problem is, how do you know that representation really represents the cookies in a valid way, reliable way? Well, you can take the photo and hold it up against the photo from your mind and hold it up against the real box of cookies. But the problem is, you never see the real box of cookies. All you're doing is comparing it with another photo.
That's right. pretty much.
I can really understand how
they came up with existentialism now because of all the skepticism and everything.
But it's like Solomon said, with increased knowledge comes increased grief. The more we learn, the more we know about what we do not know. Augustine did a lot of work, though, in this area about Jesus Christ as the one who enlightens every mind. And it's like, we know things, we just can't figure out how we know them, but Jesus Christ turns that light on in every mind, even in non-believers. Doesn't mean that they're saved at all. But dualism leads to skepticism about the real world, because no perception can be proven or disproven, because every perception is just a representation or a photo of what really exists. We never have the real object in our mind.
Also a personal thing, so we can also lead to relativism.
It kind of relativism about what really occurs or what really is out there. There is such a distinction between the real object and the perceived object, you know, that brings up the idea of like a Immanuel Kant comes to mind, where we can know things as they appear to us, we just can't know things as they really exist. So you get a distinction, a wall between the real object and the perceived object. And another problem is the distinction between real space and time and perceived space and time. You end up even in the realm of space and time. Well, that's how you perceive it. How do you know that that really represents the real space and time that supposedly really exists? Another view of dualism, and remember, so it sets up or builds a wedge between the two. So the external world and our ideas or perceptions about it, you build a wall that neither can pass, and you can never test your perceptions. Phenomenalism, A.J. Ayer's...
Is this part of dualism?
Still the second type of dualism. Phenomenalism was a special form of dualism that originated in the philosophy of A.J. Ayer. He said that in sense data language, we state how things appear to us is not material object language, how things really are. Problems with this here, a question comes up, why should we remove ourselves in such a way from reality? The questions of reality are left totally open. You know, all you're saying then is if we just use sense data language, all we're talking about is how things appear to us. We never really do talk about how things really are. You know? To say that if you see the ceiling caving in, getting ready to fall on John, to say the ceiling's falling on your head, all I'm saying is it appears to me the ceiling's falling on your head, but it doesn't say anything about reality, so then why should I even warn you then? Questions of reality are left open. We are left with statements about how reality appears to us and nothing else. Now the third view is the view of idealism, which is the view that material objects don't exist independently of some consciousness of them. Material objects don't exist independently of some consciousness of them. Okay?
Does that necessarily mean human consciousness?
Not necessarily. We're going to see with Bishop George Berkeley. But all reality is reduced exclusively to conscious beings and their mental states, okay? So
this is where they get the argument about the watchmaker and the...
You know, not the watchmaker, that's...
Well, I mean, you know, walk through the forest, you find a watch wall, or if a tree falls in the woods, if somebody wasn't there to hear it, does it really...
Yeah. If nobody perceived it falling, did it really fall? If nobody was in, when we go leave this room, a pure idealist would say that if we close this door and leave this room, the room no longer exists.
And say until we come back and open the door.
Yeah, until somebody, okay, the weaker form, Bishop George Berkeley, who lived from 1685 to 1753, said there is no independent world or reality outside of experience. He said to be is to be perceived. He reduced the world to subjectivity. Somebody has to subjectively perceive something for it to exist. Okay? The so-called physical states are shared by a number of minds. Subjective experiences are when only one person, one perceiver sees it. Still, both physical and subjective states have no existence outside of conscious experience. So then the question comes up to Berkeley, does an object not perceived go out of existence? Berkeley would say no, for the all-seeing God always perceives all objects everywhere. Okay, so that's with Berkeley. That's only with the weaker form. Okay? The weaker form of idealism says that when we leave this room still exists because God perceives everything. God is all-seeing. And so God always perceives it, so it always exists in the mind of God. When we perceive it, we're perceiving something from the reality, which means we're receiving something from God's mind. But everything that exists, exists as ideas. That's why it's called idealism. You know, means everything that exists, exists as an idea in somebody's mind. Now, the Christian idealist would say everything doesn't go out of existence when we don't perceive it, because God still perceives it. The whole universe exists always as an idea in God's mind.
The major problem there, though, is differentiating between potential and actual.
Pretty much the difference. Yeah, to a certain degree, there really wouldn't be. And it's a whole different... the problem with every philosophical view is there's... If it's a good, solid philosophical view, there's usually good arguments for it, but there's still good arguments against us. And what it shows how little we as human beings do know. So he says that God is the source of our ideas of a material world. Problems with this view? What if God is a deceiver? Maybe no material, the problem with the view is God a deceiver? Because after all, no material world, at least the way we think of the material, no material world really exists. God's deceiving us. He's fooling us. He's making us think there's a solid table there, but in actuality, there really isn't a solid table. The scary thing is, with modern science, they showed us the table was a lot less solid than we thought it was. And therefore, you know, that kind of gives a little bit of credence to idealism. But, God didn't deceive us into thinking the world was flat. And just because we all thought it, we shouldn't have blamed God. Maybe we shouldn't blame God in that area. I think that they'd probably argue along those lines. But problems, of course, the idealists can't even have a round world or a spherical world. Another problem is it is difficult to live as an idealist. What's that?
Back up one. You said an idealist cannot have a round world.
But even a spherical world, it doesn't exist as far as a hard spherical world, even. So even when he uses that argument, even if he uses the argument that we used to think the world was flat, well, strictly speaking, from an idealist standpoint, the world isn't even spherical. You know, it's all it is an idea. If there isn't a material globe out there. You see what I'm getting at? Everything that exists only as ideas. But and that's not a major point anyway, so don't worry about it. Once you have a test or another problem, though, it is difficult to live as an idealist. Very close. He was accused of being an idealist. He said that the big reason why people didn't understand him was he never really left the realm of epistemology. He wasn't really getting into metaphysics. So, I say this, though, too. If I really do have this chair in my mind, maybe the real chair, the essence of that chair, is the universal concept chair,
and that universal idea chair, and I can have that essence, the essence of the chair in my mind. And I think Aquinas argued a little bit along those lines, but it gets into a lot more than philosophy 101 when we start talking along those lines. The stronger form of idealism, that was the weaker form of Berkeley, the stronger form is not just the world is reduced to subjectivity, but even the self. Well, first off, number one, you don't have this all-seeing God that perceives everything. But number two, not just the world is reduced to subjectivity, even the self is assigned to subjectivity. So even your own existence, even the idea that you're having ideas, is called into question. And the problem, again, is that that cannot be lived. And, you know, it makes you wonder if a view that cannot be lived, if it's even worth holding at all.
So the conclusion from that would be that when we all leave, we're going to shut that door again, this room is gone, disappears until we open that door again and perceive it again.
No, this view is so much stronger than that that you don't even exist.
I think you should leave, John.
The stronger view is even the self. Itself. And so it's a problem even if you're not even if you weren't perceiving anything, because even yourself is called into question.
Sure, too. Looking at it empirically, the concept in our mind, a lot of times what something is to us by definition is based on what use we have for it. Like chair, I could call it, instead of a chair, I could define that as a stand if all I ever used it for was to change light bulbs and I never sat down in it. Just like little children, most of the times they don't know, until they see what the use for something is, they don't know what to do with it other than cram it in their mouths.
I think more of what they're getting at, though, and there's an element of truth there, more of what they're getting at is the chairness of the chair was what it was designed to be.
Right.
And the fact is, you can use chairs to stand on.
Yeah,
it's one of the uses.
You something pretty much for anything.
Yeah.
Now, this wrong form here sounds a lot like quantum theory. Quantum theory, the wave theory, they believe that they never get a Schrodinger cat. You put a cat in a box, and you have a radioactive source, and you have a certain molecule decay that leads to the poison that kills the cat. Well, the question is, if the box is closed up, is the cat alive or dead?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer that quantum physics has come up with is, the cat isn't alive or dead until somebody opens the box and looks. And at that point, the standard wave collapses, the terminology, the standard collapses, and the cat either lives or dies.
One of the problems, though, with quantum physics, and I don't understand everything that you just said, so I could be misunderstanding, but one of the problems with quantum physics, though, is you will have New Age guys bringing their religion into quantum physics and dogmatically saying, like Heisenberg's principle, the principle of uncertainty.
Right.
It does not teach that things happen on the quantum level without a cause. All it teaches is that we can't figure out what the causes are. Max Planck says that just because we don't know the causes doesn't mean that there aren't any. So one of the world's leading physicists admits that it's just something we don't know. Now, if you assume that we're omniscient and then we don't know the causes that occur there, whatever it is what if you... If you note the location of the quantum particle,
you can know either the speed or the location, but not both.
Not both, yeah. And once you know one, then
you cannot know the other.
And there's even the possibility to suggest that our observing it may cause our observing it brings another factor into it, which could cause it to move or. Could cause a change in the speed or whatever.
Well, the theory there is that the particle doesn't have a location or a speed until you choose to observe one of the two,
mm-hmm.
And then it achieves both, but you can only observe one.
And see, where science, I've been saying this for years too, where science is going now that we have postmodern man, it is going to be used for this going back to Zeno and. Parmenides and Heraclitus, it's going to be going back to try to attempt to prove monism. We are going to... modern science... you cannot do modern science without a religion. You have to have a philosophical... Modern science was started by Christians, and they saw us as examining God's creation, thinking God's thoughts after his, after him.
Who is that for?
Yeah. I don't remember if it was Francis Bacon or if it was Newton. But then it became the atheist trying to find evidence to prove how the universe is self-sufficient and we don't need God. And now that that's becoming bankrupt, what is turning into is a New Age philosophy, evidence that we are just cells in this one being called the universe. And that's the direction we're going in, and things can happen without a cause. Therefore, throw the laws of logic out the window. A can equal not A, and that's the direction we're heading. We're going into Buddhism. People are trying to prove Buddhism from quantum physics. But the conclusion here is that skepticism results if we cannot guarantee the relationship between the realm of ideas and a material world. If we leave it at dualism, we have ideas here and the external world there, and never the two shall meet, you get nothing but skepticism. Dualism ends up collapsing into idealism, okay? Because all you end up with is you can know the ideas you're having, but you can't know if it says anything about the real world.
And so you end up with
Immanuel Kant's skepticism, because we can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. So skepticism results in we can't guarantee the relationship between the realm of ideas and the material world. Though realism has problems, Geisler and Feinberg argue that some sophisticated form of it best fits with common sense. Physiology, the psychology of perception, and the functioning of the material world through the natural sciences would explain errors in perception. In other words, we would argue for the basic reliability of sense experience, not the infallible reliability of sense experience, and we would use other checks of the five senses to take care of problems with perception. Now, you can see a problem. If you look ahead, you can see a problem with that, though. And the problem is, if this sense experience is mistaken,
and
how do you know all these other sense experiences aren't mistaken to help it out? But, you know, we usually weigh them, and there's more evidence for this than that, but we can't be totally sure. Now, we do have some time left, so let's get started into the next chapter. Chapter 10, How Are Beliefs Justified? How Are Beliefs Justified? Chapter 10. There's two basic views here. And one is foundationalism. Foundationalism. I'll probably just give you an overview of this chapter, and then we'll cover it in more depth in the next lecture. But how are beliefs justified? So we deal with justification of beliefs. There's foundationalism. And then there's also coherentism. Okay, now, just remember the word coherent, and that'll help you with that second one. Now, foundationalism is the view that knowledge is structured in such a way that its foundations support the rest of knowledge. So these foundations are themselves in need of no support. So you have kind of like a pyramid. You have foundational beliefs. Yeah. Usually, I think if you put the pyramid upside down, it'll make more sense because it's probably a lot less first principles than what you would reason from there. But what we're getting at is there's a base there, a foundation. First principles, things like self-evident truths. We can't prove it. There's no other principles below it to prove it. But these just are self-evident. When we think of them, we know they're true. We can't prove them. We can't prove it, because then it would end up in an infinite regress. But we just know they're true, or they're beyond beliefs beyond reasonable doubt. So epistemic justification is like the pyramid. Beliefs in the lower tier are justifiably believed without appeal to any other reason. Okay? You don't need to get out of your reason, you'd have an infinite regress, and you never have anything, any first principles. There can't be principles before first principles, or there'd be no first principles at all. It wouldn't be first at all. The beliefs in the higher tiers are ultimately justified by the lowest tier foundational beliefs. So these beliefs are justified by the ones below them, and then by the ones below them, and then by the ones below them, until you get to the foundational truths. Now, the support for foundationalism is that there are only two alternatives to foundationalism. One is circular justification. That would say that A is B, or because, well, A is B because, or,
because B is C.
Yeah, I think circular reason would say
A, B, because B is C.
We know A is true because B is true. Well, how do you know B is true? Well, I know B is true because C is true. How do you know C is true? Because A is true.
Yeah.
You see, you go right back there and you're arguing in a circle.
That's where you have false premises, a valid argument,
yeah,
and a true and a valid argument leads to a false conclusion.
Yeah, and it would be like arguing God does not exist. Well, how do you know God doesn't exist? Well, because miracles are given as proof that he exists, and miracles have never happened. Well, how do you know miracles never happen? Because if miracles happen, God would have to exist. And I've already proven that God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't proven that God doesn't exist. Yes, I did, because I proved miracles, but you didn't prove miracles didn't happen. And you're just arguing in a circle. And there's no real... That would be an alternative. The only other alternative is an infinite regress. How do you know A is true? Well, because B is true. Well, how do you know B is true? Well, because C is true. How do you know C is true? Well, because D is true. How do you know D is true? Because E is true. You go on and on, and then you have no real basis for any knowledge. So either way makes knowledge impossible to be justified. And since both alternatives are absurd, justification must come to an end somewhere, or no belief is justified. Therefore, there must be some foundational truth. I hold to a form of foundationalism, but I do not believe that we know the foundational beliefs with certainty. But I believe that God has made certain truths self-evident to us, so just to communicate, just to live, we have to assume certain things to be true. Okay? To communicate, you've got to assume the existence not only of your mind, but of the mind of the person you communicate with. So things that are actually undeniable, or their denial is forced and temporary, or they're beyond reasonable doubt, or what we would call our founding fathers call self-evident truth. Now, there's some criticisms and objections of foundationalism. We might be able to get through these chapters. Some criticisms and objections. Number one, there is no incorrigible statements that can be foundational. In other words, we don't have anything, any belief can be questioned. So we don't have any unquestionable beliefs to form the foundation. response, his response is, hey, justification has to stop somewhere. And not all knowledge is capable of incorrigible foundations. You know, geometry, you can break it down to its axioms, which are true by definition, but some things you're just going to have to, some branches of knowledge are just going to have things that are true beyond reasonable doubt. Another criticism is there are no directly justified beliefs. You could always ask for reasons why a person believes anything. Another argument against foundationalism is that in the end it leads either to an infinite regress or dogmatism. Response is it doesn't lead to infinite regress. It's the only escape from infinite regress of justification for beliefs. You know, it's the only way you can stop and looking for justifications is to stop somewhere at some first principles. Also, there may be some self-evident truth that man just accepts as being true. Maybe only the philosopher denies them. The denial is forced contemporary. You deny them in the philosophy lecture hall.
So you're not
but in real life, yeah, I do. Yeah, and what I'm doing, I'm responding to each of the criticisms. A response to some premises are self-justified since they can't be denied without contradiction or at, you know, even, and I'm not even talking about logical. They're true by logical necessity. I'm talking about they're actually undeniable. Like if we deny our own existence, we have to actually exist to make the denial, and therefore it's true by actual undeniability. Another criticism, well, the foundational beliefs aren't logically necessary. But the response to this would be that to demand all justification be logically necessary would require that all of our knowledge is indubitable or logically necessary, which is to ask too much. We don't have to have foundational beliefs that are logically necessary. To have foundational beliefs that are actually undeniable or beyond reasonable doubt would be good enough. Others would argue there aren't enough foundational beliefs for a comprehensive epistemology. I'd say, you know, let's talk about what our foundational beliefs are. What we have to believe, just a dialogue. And I think we've got enough foundational beliefs there to prove the existence of God. If I accept a debate, he accepts the existence of himself. And of the guy he's debating, usually if he's an evolutionist, he holds the existence of the material world or the contingent world dependent on something else for his existence. You don't have to argue for God's existence. You can get an awful lot of knowledge from that. There's also the criticism of theory-ladenness, which is basically the view that all our beliefs are affected by theory and presuppositions. And if true, then there would be no foundations. The response that Geisler gives here from Feinberg is that the closer one theory is to reality, the less theory-laden it is, the less theory-laden beliefs are the foundational ones. In other words, the atheist and the Christian are not going to believe or agree on a lot of beliefs, but there are going to be something that both atheists and theists agree upon, and those would be the things that we would look for as the foundation. So I would hope some form of foundationalism, so long as we don't require logical necessity for the foundation of every field of knowledge. Now coherentism, also called contextualism, is not a pyramid. It's viewed more as a web of beliefs. Okay, more as a web of beliefs.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a web, but it's supposed to be a web of beliefs there.
Four more to reach you.
There you go.
More of a web of beliefs, not a pyramid. And there's a mutual relationship between various beliefs. A supports B, B supports C, and then C turns around and supports A. Well, you need to go right back into circular reasoning. This is why I don't hold to this. Beliefs closer to the center of the web are given up more reluctantly. You know, but it depends whose web you're talking to as to what those beliefs would be. Support for this view, any objection against foundationalism would support this view, if those objections held any water. Another support for this view, the claim that there are no immediately justified beliefs, therefore that all reasoning's got to, in one way or another, be circular. Criticisms and objections of this view, coherentism theory leads to an infinite regress, because you just go on and on. It's also ultimately all beliefs fail to be justified. It's circular reasoning is involved with it. And coherentism theory is cut off from the real world because a person can be justified in believing just about everything, anything. Geisler and Feinberg conclude this chapter by saying that Christian epistemologists are on both sides of this issue. And an agreement can be found. There is some similarities. The foundationalists will allow basic beliefs that are not incorrigible and reasons that aren't logically conclusive. He would move more, a little bit more, towards coherentism. And if the coherentist will accept the view that beliefs at the outer edge of the web are further from experience, and the ones at the center are a lot like the foundational beliefs, they can kind of meet. But I think what it really takes is the coherentist accepting a reasonable form of foundationalism. That's why I'm a foundationalist. A Christian cannot accept agnosticism or relativism or skepticism about the real world. And I think foundationalism, I think the only way that these two can meet is if the coherentist becomes a foundationalist. Therefore, I'm more of a foundationalist. I believe there are certain beliefs that are actually undeniable, that are beyond reasonable doubt to a certain degree. They're self-evident. We know they're true. We just don't know how they're true. And those are the kinds of premises that their denial is forced and temporary.